Well, happy holidays, everybody. Yes, I'm alone. No round table set today. But I'm not really alone. We're going to hear from some of our favorite hosts and our favorite episodes. Yes, it's the best of 2020 coming up next on TWiT. All this year, This Week in Tech has come to you from TWiT's LastPass studios. Now, you're focused on security, but are your employees? LastPass can ensure they are by making access and authentication seamless, whether employees are working in the office or remotely. Visit LastPass.com/TWiT to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 803 for December 27th, 2020, the year's best. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Zendesk. Zendesk makes software for better customer service. They help empower support agents and give them the right tools. You could say they're champions of customer service. Visit Zendesk.com/TWiT to learn more. What a year it's been. Hello, everybody. I'm Leo Laporte. We decided to give all of our hosts the week off for the holidays by making our editors and producers and staff work twice as hard to put together this best of episode. I'm sorry, guys. Thank you to Karsten Bondi and Jason Howell. Thanks to our editors, John and Kevin and Victor. Thanks to our executive producer, my own dear wife, Lisa. And, of course, Jerry Wagley, our supervising producer, and Anthony Nielsen, who is a hardworking guy in charge of all of our productions. He is a great creative. They've all worked very hard, including the back office staff, Debbie and Sarah and Ashley and our accounting staff, Penny and Robin. Have I left people out? Oh, yeah, I left the most important people out. Our studio team. The great John Slonina, Jammer B, and Burke McQuinn. Thank you, John and Burke, for keeping the tape rolling. And, of course, Russell Tammany, our IT guy. He's not an employee. He's a contractor, works for a lot of other companies. But, boy, Russell's love for TWiT and the streaming that we do has helped us stay on the air. I hope I haven't left anybody out, but every one of you is a crucial part of what happens, of what goes on at TWiT. I did. I left out Masako in our marketing department. I'm going down. I haven't seen you all in so long. 2020 has been a very strange year. Everybody's been working from home. I'm the only guy coming into the studio. All of our other hosts, Micah Sargent, Jason Howell, Anthony Pruitt, they're all staying home to stay safe, as I hope you are as well. But we've managed to still put together, I think, a pretty good run of shows for 2020. And our big show, This Week in Tech, is no exception. Let's start at the very beginning of the year, before we even knew what was coming in 2020, a wrap-up from what may well be the last tech convention ever, CES 2020. CES was all last week. None of us are sick. This is an unheard-of proposition.
Hey, this is 3 years in a row for me.
The incubation period, we're still within it.
Oh, we're still with it.
Still happen.
Still technically could be carriers.
That's fair.
I haven't been in 8 years. And one of the reasons I didn't go for so long, partly is it's just a nightmare. In fact, a lot of, you know, last week I asked my panel, how many of you are going to CES? And none of them are going because they're all senior enough in tech journalists, they don't have to go.
Right.
Nobody imposes on themselves like we did, Ant.
Right.
That's nuts. Or like you guys do. Right. All of you could have recused yourselves. There's something fun about it, though. I liken it to a football game. If you go to an NFL game, you go for the atmosphere, for the fun, not to see the game. You could see it much better at home on your TV than you can, and you know, even if you have good seats, because it's distant and it's people running around, and CES is like that. You can only get, it's like the elephant and the blind men. You can only get, it's 4,500 booths. That means, you know, more than, you know, 12,000 products.
You only have so much time.
It's impossible in 4 days to even scratch the surface.
Right.
So, you know, you'd be better off if you care about CES to let everybody else go read all the coverage. But if you want to get the so once in a while, I think it's fun to go get the atmosphere. All of you go all the time, right?
I go for the swag.
Yeah,
he's just
you
not
brought some
lie.
Swag.
I'm pretty good at getting swag.
You know,
when I first started going, I could remember prior to actually being able to go, hearing folks like yourself and other senior.
Say, oh, I could never go.
Like, no, I don't want to go back.
I hate this.
And I was like, really? But after going two times or so, I could see why you would feel
it's
that
hard.
Way because it is a grind. I mean,
it's hard.
You are running around.
It's hard
you better
to get
have
around.
The right shoes on.
And if you're covering it, if you're it's easier if you're not working it.
Right.
If you're I've done it where I'm just hanging out, and that's actually fun.
Right.
But if you're working, you feel an onus to guys see as much as possible.
Right.
I think I went to North, Central, and South Halls. I went to the Sands Expo Center. I went to the Venetian. I mean, and I still didn't get to Mandalay Bay, and I still missed thousands of products I wanted to see.
Right.
Jason, how do you do it?
Well, we have 90 people.
That helps.
So the way that we do it is we cut it up into little chunks, and we try to get down every aisle of every exhibit.
Do you
hall.
Do it by beat? Do you say, okay, Lexi, you're going to cover health tech and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Yeah,
we do. It's by and large, but then we still even have to slice and dice it, right? Because there's some that have overlapping beats. There's some things there that is in nobody's beat. And so we have to really be strategic about
the way
we approach
it. Who'd you put in charge of the sex toys?
That's health tech. Health tech.
We have a culture team. So it's actually true. It's culture. We have a culture team. And then we also have a team that's focused on health and wellness.
This was a big story, partly because it has the word SEX in it. But this was a big story because last year, the Consumer Electronics Association, which runs CES, inadvertently gave an award to a vibrator, then yanked it. I shouldn't.
Wait a minute.
Pulled it back.
Not that either.
Canceled it.
Thank you.
And got a lot of heat. In fact, the company that created that and won the award and then lost the award was smart and went out, did out press releases, went on a tour. They got more coverage than they would have otherwise. And I think the CEA said, oops, that was a mistake. Because we've allowed, they used to have adult corner where they'd have adult videotapes in there, right? Eventually they had to exile that across the hall. But it was very sexist that they said, well, you can't have women's health products, but you can have men's.
Exactly.
Right.
I don't know if health.
They just tried to treat it like adults this year. I think that's the
I think
thing.
That was better. Now, of course, I'm the one who's not. So did you see it again? So
there were 10 booths.
I have to say there were a lot of them and I avoided it. I didn't want to cover it. I didn't want to I didn't even know how.
I personally didn't have any interest in it, but that's just me.
I went to a suite that had a bunch of products and I came away.
Did you wear your collar?
I was wearing my collar.
Oh God, that's so good.
And
I came away
that.
With a gift bag and I didn't open it up till I got back to my house and there were two of them in there. I'm like, oh,
right.
How am I going to explain that when I get back to the Vatican?
It's kind of embarrassing, and I don't want to be sexist about it. It is ridiculous that women's health and women's pleasure was somehow second class to men's pleasure.
Right.
So I'm glad that they did the right thing, but at the same time, do you have any computers? Are there is there anything else I can look at?
I will only say two things. One. A well-designed product actually is amazing because it's not just a product. You have to design it for comfort. Well, you have to design it with proper materials. The second thing is...
And they're Bluetooth and Wi-Fi enabled in many cases.
That I do not like because and this is not just for health technology.
But
this is for any technology. When security gets slapped on as an afterthought, you are just asking for trouble.
Yeah.
But they don't know that in their R&D just yet.
Exactly. They're not even considering.
Right.
But you've got these internet-enabled applications. And I'm like, do you really want that?
Yeah.
I mean, unless you've actually considered how that can be abused, that should not be a feature.
Yeah.
Well said.
Anyway. So good. So if you want coverage, don't come to Twit for that. You can go to CNET. They had a whole section. Apple's new privacy features have further rattled the location-based ad market. This is one for the good guys. You know that pop-up you get on iOS 13, you get it on Android now too, when it says, hey, Google has just, checked your location 4 times in the last 24 hours. You know that pop-up? And it says, do you want to allow that? Or maybe only when the app's open or maybe not at all? So that's been going on since iOS 13 was released in September. Ad tech sources are saying it has been a big hit to the amount of data they can gather. Digiday quotes Benoit Grouchko, who has a great name, by the way. Benoit Grouchko, he runs the ad tech business Temo. They do software for apps to collect that location data. He says 3 years ago, opt-in rates, almost 100%. Almost everybody left location on. Ever since iOS 13, the opt-in rate now is often below 50%. People, when they're given the choice, say, you know what, no. 7 in 10 iOS 13 location signals analyzed by Location Sciences. In the 6 weeks after iOS 13 came out, 80% of those users stopped all background tracking across their devices. So if you're in the business of selling based on location, publicity agency Starcom said this impacts the ability to tie users that research online and purchase in store, driving and measure footfall for clients. This is something Google offers, by the way. Google monitors credit card purchases and then says to an advertiser, hey, this guy saw your ad on Tuesday and went to the store and bought your product on Wednesday. Your ad's working. Not as easy. Not as easy. Time to celebrate, Georgia. You're an iPhone user.
I am. I love it. I love it.
And what do you do when you see that pop up?
I'll always opt out. I'm actually shocked that there's 50% of people that say that they will still allow it. What are you doing? Stop it. It's creepy. Would you want someone walking around tracking you? If you could see them, you know, snooping into your bathroom, looking at what you're doing, what you're surfing around, you'd say, stop doing that. You'd close your blinds. There's a few of us maybe that'd be like, yay, into that. Most people would say, no, stop following me around everywhere I go.
Actually, you know what? I'm weird, Georgia. I always say I always allow. In fact, it pisses me off because Apple doesn't usually give always allow as an option. There's really, most of the time, I see two options. Allow when app is in use, don't allow. You have to go into the settings to turn on always allow. And I do. Because I want them to know.
What do you want them to know?
Everything.
Everything. I like it.
Patrick knows.
I feel like they care.
Do you think that you get better targeted ads?
Yes.
Why?
What's wrong with that? I think I get better ads. I walk by the Levi's store and it says, hey, here's a coupon. You can go in. My Google Maps. I love that feature where I can look at my timeline and see all the places I've been. Why wouldn't I want that? Do you think they're following me around? Is it like somebody in
it is like following you around.
No, it's
again,
not.
It's
the best part of this conversation is like 2 minutes ago, it was like, I don't want law enforcement to be able to track us everywhere.
Right.
And the reality is through third-party marketing tools, if they can identify your phone, which is not that hard to do, the level of mapping and tracking they can do now without using any official tools is kind of terrifying.
I don't worry about Google. You're saying, but you should realize that Google might be giving that information to the cops.
Or it's actually turned out a lot of apps sell the tracking information to third party services, which are then, you know, people can walk up with a credit card number and get information that you would freak out if it was made available directly from Google or from Apple.
For example,
the car, the amount of information the cars track is utterly terrifying at this point. Like, I may never buy a new car again based on the amount of information that's being pulled out of the
Oh, man, I drove a Tesla. I would call Tesla and say, you know, in fact, this happened. You know, I had it in forward and your car went backward. And they say, well, no, wait a minute. What time did that happen? Well, this afternoon. And look, no, you were going, you had it in forward. I could see the log.
No, the sensor registered it as forward, not.
That's right. What I should have said. It's your sensor's fault.
Yeah. Patrick, would it depend on the amount of torque, though?
Well, if it accidentally goes into reverse and you bump into it, you know, with your, I'm going to pick on
Come
Prius
on.
Because it's here. No, well, actually,
I don't mind if Elon knows, and I don't mind if Google knows. Google's not handing my information over to law enforcement. In unprecedented geofence searches,
but it's all those other apps.
They're not what
you know. I've got Android 10 on my Pixel 3 now. And right. They added the same thing in there so that now in all the apps, you can go in and set your location preferences by app, to always allow, allow when in use or never allow. And I was shocked, after upgrading to 10, some of these apps that were coming up and asking, for location permission that they had, games and stuff that had no business knowing where I was. I don't mind, Google Maps. Having my location. I mean, that's why it's there.
Maps won't work.
Things like, Lyft or Uber, clearly they need to know where I am when I'm using them. But there is no reason for a ride hailing app to know where I am when I'm not using the app. Anytime that I'm not using the app, it's off. Okay. And I think the only app I have set to always allow is Google Maps because, like you, Leo, I like the timeline. Yeah. I find it useful.
Plus, I want to help law enforcement when there's a robbery they want to know everybody who was in 500 feet of the robbery.
But it's so
a gold jacket and a gold hard hat was at this location.
Look at your cameras. You can't miss me.
Well, I think it's about transparency, though. It's that you don't really know what they're going to be doing with it and who they're going to be selling it to and what they're going to be using it for. There are no regulations to make sure that they're really being honest and it's legible. No one reads the privacy. I have every once in a while, it's terrifying. And then I always don't, if I really want the app, I won't read it because then I will say no, but no one reads it. It's illegible. So it's a big problem.
Actually, I'll be honest. I almost always select only when using app, because that seems reasonable to me. And if it's an app that shouldn't have location information, if it's Fortnite or something, then I say no.
Remember the flashlight app that some nefarious company bought, and then it was basically, it went from being like, you can turn on the light for your camera when you're not actually using your camera. And then they did an update, and it was looking for information. It was basically accessing all possible information on your phone, your photos, your contact information, everything. It was kind of fascinating to watch because, the millions of downloads for this was before they integrated this stuff into the operating system. People kept downloading it, installing it, and presumably saying, okay, that's how badly they wanted a flashlight app. But there's an article that the New York Times did back in the middle of December, 12 million phones, one data set, zero privacy, where somebody turned over a data set, which was 50 billion pings, quote, 50 billion pings from the phones of more than 12 million Americans as they moved through several major cities, including Washington, New York, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. Basically, because apps that would track you and then report the information, it also meant that these unregulated, third-party app data collection centers could allow anybody with that information to, track the location of, people who probably shouldn't be tracked or don't want to be tracked, whether they are celebrities or, exes or, abused. It's kind of amazing how much information is out there and just the William Gibson line, it's my favorite. The street finds its own uses for things. The street's going to find its own use for this information, and it might be creepy as hell.
That's actually a really important point, is that you can invent a technology and have an idea about how it's going to be used. Law enforcement can have an idea, but, with key escrow, we'll only use the ring of power if for good, not evil. But the street finds its own uses is a really good thing to keep in mind. I like that, Patrick. Yeah.
William Gibson.
Yeah. It just is, that's the nature of technology. It flows like water. This year, the iPad celebrated its 10th anniversary. We're going to take a look back to the iPad 10 years ago in just a minute. But before we do, I'd like to thank our sponsor. It's very nice to have sponsors on our Best of shows. And Zendesk is a great sponsor. Customer service is something I really believe in. I think a good company can get to great by doing great customer service, and that's where Zendesk comes in. Whether you're buying stuff online or calling your bank or using an app to get a ride to an airport, I think you know which companies do it right and which companies don't. Sometimes even great teams can struggle to make their customers feel taken care of. That's why Zendesk is so great. Their award-winning support, sales, and customer engagement software help businesses go to the next level by offering personal service at scale. So your team can create conversational experiences that keep customers happy. And you know, customers are very quick. If something goes wrong on a phone call to a bank, who hasn't had a frustrating experience calling a company? That word goes out. People tweet about it. They tell their friends. On the other hand, and I want to encourage everybody to do this, when you have a great customer experience, you remember it, don't you? And you go back. I try only to deal with companies that give me that feeling that they care about me as a customer. A great customer experience, it's so important. And I'm betting most of the companies that I really like are using Zendesk. You can communicate seamlessly across every channel, email, phone, chat, messenger, community forums, help centers, social media. Zendesk uses a term, I think it's a really good one, called, they call it a conversational experience. What makes it conversational? Well, it's connected, it's ongoing, but most importantly, it's genuine. It's a natural customer interaction. And if you can create that feeling that it's a one-to-one experience, you have a customer for life. That's what Zendesk enables, with a complete customer profile, a unified set of tools that give you the context you need to deliver great service in every conversation. Now, most software support requires expensive consultants, months of setup, not Zendesk. It just takes hours for you to get it up and running. It's easy to implement. It's fast. And even so, they scale to meet changing needs. You know, when you're a small business, good customer service isn't so hard. As you get bigger, it gets harder and harder. Zendesk is with you every step of the way. They give organizations the flexibility to move quickly, to focus on innovation, to adapt to growth. And I think the proof is in the pudding. 150,000 paid customer accounts, over a decade of experience. Zendesk is, I would say, pretty good. Well, let's say darn good at customer experience themselves. No matter what your business needs, Zendesk products are flexible enough to pave the path that's best for your organization. See for yourself why the best customer experiences are built with Zendesk. Get started at Zendesk.com/twit. That's Zendesk.com/TWIT. Thank you, Zendesk, for your support. It's really great to have you on our Best Of episode. And thank you, dear viewer, dear listener, for supporting us by visiting Zendesk.com/twit. That's very important. Now we go on with the show. I guess one of the big stories of 10 years ago was the iPad. And we celebrated its 10th anniversary this year. We took a look back. Watch. So this last week was the 10th anniversary of the iPad. I thought the iPad was a pretty good thing. I like my iPad. Apparently, I'm a loser. Everybody agrees. The iPad, Ben Thompson, the headline on Stratechery, the tragic iPad. John Gruber, it's a disappointment. Even in this thing, Devendra, that you and everybody else got to do, but I wasn't invited to, that Jason Snell does the... Apple report card. You would have given the iPad the D+ or something. I thought the iPad was pretty good. What's wrong with the iPad? What'd you
That's
give
a good
it?
Question.
What'd you give it, Devendra?
I forget.
You don't remember
in the report card, but it does seem like we should at least give the iPad credit for being the tablet that survived. You know, which is the thing that inspired everybody to make tablets, and now like. There are certainly very few Android tablets that I think are worth buying. Microsoft took the strategy of like trying to turn Windows into the tablet thing. So convertible PCs technically are tablet-like, but I still don't like the way Windows handles tablet stuff. So, you know, the iPad is the only successful tablet, and that makes a lot of sense. It's been doing good business for them. I think where Apple falters is in terms of like supporting multitasking. They were slow to that. They were slow to like turning the iPad into a usable computing platform. But as a tablet, I think they deserve credit for at least being successful and, trying to push things forward.
I will tell you what you said, because I have the transcript. You actually said, every gadget geek should own one. And actually, I overstated its bad grade. It got a B+.
B+ sounds about right. That's not, certainly, as of last year or 2 years ago when the base iPad was like $230, it's like, yeah, you should have one. Yeah. I have one.
Yeah.
Like it's
everybody should have one.
That was the first iPad I bought myself too. And I bought it specifically so my parents can FaceTime my baby daughter. And it's been perfect for that. So every night at dinner time, hit a button, you know, go straight to my mom's phone or my dad's phone, and they get to see Sophia every single night. And that is far easier than most other solutions out there.
One thing a lot of people agreed on, including Ben Thompson and John Gruber, is the multitasking, the split screen and the slide over. They seem to agree that that's very poorly implemented. I think everybody on MacBreak Weekly said, yeah, they should just dump the multitasking because it doesn't work very well. And this they blame this not on Steve Jobs, whose original conception they think was right on, I would agree, but on subsequent software developers over the years. I think we can blame.
Sorry,
we can blame who's the scapegoat everybody at Apple blames for everything wrong with Apple. He was fired. I can't remember his name, but he's it's like, oh, we got rid of him. He's
Johnny Ive.
No, maybe you could blame Johnny now.
We blame Johnny Ive for a lot. Yeah.
Rubenstein or somebody like that.
No, yeah. It was. I can't remember his name. Anymore.
The guy that did the map stuff. But yeah. but Leo, how much of this is? And I think about this a lot. Like, there's certain people out there who maybe we can blame Steve Jobs because he made the trucks versus cars thing. So there's a certain segment of people that believed that tablets would replace the computer, right? And so the fact that 10 years on, that's what this is about, right? Is that there are certain people that are disappointed that you still need something with a keyboard and a mouse. So if it's just that it's not doing everything yet, that doesn't mean that it's a failure as a product, right?
Mm-hmm. No, yep. I think a lot of the complaints are more that it should be better. It should be more like
stagnant.
That it's a little stagnant. And I think with iPad OS, they've been making some progress. But I guess people wanted more from the iPad.
I do feel like, the iPad Pro, right, was their next step.
Scott
for
Forstall.
Hardware.
Thank you, chat room. Scott Forstall. It's all Scott's fault.
It's all Scott's fault. iPad Pro, though, great hardware. Like, we've loved the hardware. It's been well-reviewed, since they launched that thing. And certainly in the most recent years, like, it's beautiful. But the software has always been slow to catch up to that hardware. Yeah. So Apple, they've been lagging on macOS software and iOS too. Like they have a lot of software innovation they really need to focus on. But the iPad as a computer replacement, I think a lot of people I talk to, even tech journalists, some people use that for all they do, for image editing, for reporting. I personally couldn't live that way, but it would be great for like a weekend way to go and just write a long thing and not have to worry too much about
point is that it's all these people that are like, well, I'll never need a computer again. I'll have this tablet and I can. And so it's just the disappointment of those people that imagined that that's what they were going to have by now. And what if the answer is that, again, you have a car for something, you have a truck for something, you got a semi for something. Like, so, all right, a tablet is great for, like you were saying, I did FaceTiming with the grandparents this afternoon. Like, so what that the tablet didn't kill the laptop? Like, who cares?
Yeah, yeah.
I think the problem is that it's all of this stuff's so expensive. If, like all of us, somebody's buying you this stuff, you can have an iPhone, an Apple, MacBook, a Windows machine, an iPad, and then it kind of all is a continuum of stuff, and you use the right thing for the right time. But if you had to only choose one, probably wouldn't be the iPad.
Right.
And normal people have to choose one. They're so expensive.
From my friends, I don't use a Mac, but the value prop that they have seen the most out of iOS 13 is Sidecar. And so it's they've given up on using the iPad for everything, but as a companion to their laptop, it is that feature makes it far more usable for them. And so if Apple was choosing not to focus at being standalone, but actually part of a workflow where it's easy to work with it, their applications, their other hardware, I think that is the true nature and the true purpose of iPad, where it could really shine.
Did Epson have I don't think they had a Super Bowl ad. Rocket Mortgage did that weird ad with Jason Momoa taking off his muscles. That kind of creeped me out.
I loved it.
Did you?
It was really memorable, right?
Yeah. So it worked. Do you remember who the ad was for?
It's for me. Because Jason Momoa is in it.
He's for me because Aquaman is in it. There is a great YouTube video I recommend on the making of it. They show how they did it. They had a skinny guy, and they had to match his movements, and then they would use green screen and other CGI technologies to. So obviously he couldn't really take off his muscles.
Is it similar to the way that they did Captain America, right? When Steve Rogers was a little guy,
right?
That's pretty cool.
This is, I mean, another Academy Award nominated film tonight is Irishman, in which they make Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, and Al Pacino look like they're in their 40s when they're really in their 70s and 80s. What did you think of that? Did it work? Did that CGI work?
I didn't actually see it, but it sounds to me like they just did. It was a little freaky.
Well, yeah. It was deep fakes. You're right. That's what it was. And the other weird thing is, I guess the director, Martin Scorsese, said the problem is the acting's in the eyes, so we can't change the eyes. So they all had old eyes and young faces, which was very weird. And then the other thing that was very hard to do, and I guess they brought in movement coaches, but you don't move the same when you're in your 80s as you did when you were in your 40s. So yeah. there's one scene where Robert De Niro is taking a handgun and throwing it in the bay, as one does. To get rid of the evidence, and he has to go over these rocks, and you just want to leap out and say, "Careful, Grandpa! He's just a little, you just can tell he's not a 40-year-old guy."
Yeah, I argue that de-aging, if we had had it for The Godfather, would have not had the great Robert De Niro performance that we had in Godfather 2.
Well,
that's all I'm saying.
And remember, maybe you don't remember, but I do. That in Godfather 1, the studio did not want Coppola to cast Marlon Brando as the Godfather because he was in his 40s. He was a young guy.
Right. Yeah, young.
And they forced him to do a test sequence with Brando. It was the scene where he's in the olive oil company and they're trying to convince him to deal drugs. And he says, thank you, but no thank you. And they actually shot that to prove to the studio he can look old. But that was all makeup. And that's an interesting point, because in the old days, if you think about movies like, remember Dustin Hoffman, Little Big Man, where he had to become a 100-year-old guy? Mm-hmm. And it didn't. You could tell. It's makeup.
It's makeup.
Yeah. But we suspended disbelief. We go, well, yeah, it's because it's really Dustin in his 30s wearing a lot of makeup.
Too bad makeup doesn't work the other way.
Yeah, you can't de-age people. What can you? Maybe you can.
I mean,
I think you could probably do, which is like you age yourself up just a little bit with makeup, so that when you go the other way, good makeup and good lighting,
right?
Like more fill lighting and stuff, it would look like a bigger swing than it actually was. De Niro had such a great performance in Godfather 2 as a young Marlon Brando,
right?
So it's like that to me is like I point to that every time. People go, wow, de-aging. And I'm like, but.
What about in Star Wars? Do you think that they, I don't know how they got Princess Leia in the latest Star Wars.
Well wasn't it that
clips?
If you saw the movie, all of her lines were very generic, where it was like, I can't stand to lose you again. Never underestimate a droid. It was like, they were very non-specific lines. And you could tell, If you're in production, you could really tell that they wrote around a lot of that.
Okay.
But they did one sequence that de-aged her and Mark Hamill to the events of shortly after Return of the Jedi.
Was it believable?
It was okay. It wasn't great. But it was also kind of like, it was quick enough that it was like, okay, that was fine. But if they had used it the way that they did with Grand Moff Tarkin in Rogue One, I would not have enjoyed that. That was really weird.
I didn't think Commander Tarkin was believable at all.
Very weird. Yeah, it was very, very weird.
That was from whole cloth, right? They didn't have any footage.
Yeah. They had a stand-in. It's just very, it's very strange.
How long before these deep fakes, because that's really what they are. How long before they're good enough that we could be fooled? Well, they're not fooling us now, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes.
I think they are.
They are?
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah. I think people, just like people have that short attention span and only share a headline, if that real quick kind of, real quick at a glance, oh my God, can you believe this? Like, person said this thing. Like, I think deepfakes are going to get pretty scary soon.
Nate, you think, what, have you been fooled, Nate?
I don't know. Maybe I have, and I just don't realize it. That's,
maybe I
that's
have.
Part of the problem.
Yeah,
that's part of the problem. But the thing that I always interests me with this is actually the psychological aspect, which is a lot of the time we see things that we want to see and we want to believe, and so often I think that a deepfake only has to be good enough for somebody to believe what they're seeing is accurate. I think it's different in films, because there are other elements of illusion at play there, but with politics in particular, not to go back to the start of the show again, I think that's where it gets particularly worrying, because then they don't have to be absolutely perfect for somebody who wants to believe what they're seeing is true to believe that it is true and then to spread it as if it was. And for that, it doesn't need perfection. And that's why I think we're kind of already there and why it's already scary.
Don't attempt too much. Use it subtly. Use it as in just the right place. And you know what? People aren't very good. I have to agree with you, because I watch videos all the time on Reddit and elsewhere where I think that must be made up. But I don't know.
Deep fake detection is certainly a growth industry right now.
Apparently, Google's what do they call it? Their political arm has come up with a thing called Assembler that can detect modified photos, but they're going to give it to journalists, but they're not going to give it to us. Be nice if we had that.
Just reminds me of that really old meme. Like, this is shopped. I can tell by the pixels.
But you can, right? The pixels will tell you, won't they?
I guess so. I mean, yeah.
No.
There'll always come a point where someone will find a way around, you know?
I wanted to believe that my refrigerator finally updated its firmware after 5 years, and the chat room pointed out to me quickly that I may have been wrong.
What? It didn't?
Well, I mean, it certainly appears that it did, but...
All they have to do is put something up that says, hey, we've...
Right.
It's updated. We fixed it.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a... Reddit, maybe. I blame you, Karsten, for following maybe. There was on Reddit, there used to be a subreddit called Yes, 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 and then one called No, No, No. But the problem with Yes, Yes, Yes and No, No, No is you'd know how the video was going to end. Yes, 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 it was always going to end like, wow, it worked. No, 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 it was always going to end in disaster. But maybe combines both, but cleverly eliminates any indication about which way it's going to go. Let me see if I can find the maybe that I was looking at. I showed it to a number of people and they said, that's a fake. And I thought, oh, maybe it is. I just don't know. I can't tell. I don't know if I'm gonna be able to find it. It was a claimed to be a Russian dash cam footage of a little kid wandering into the street in the snow. Maybe you could find it, Karsten, and getting rescued. And I thought it was real. Do you remember that one? You think that was real? And then Lisa said, that's not real. Yeah. Yeah. That was real? Are you sure? How do we know? How can we tell? Ready to? So there's a little boy. He's running in the road. This is from Russian dash cam footage. Everybody's getting out. They're all worried. Car comes up, picks the kid up by the collar and drives off. Saves him. Fake or real?
Oh, I buy that as real.
Really?
Gets him out of the road.
It worked. It's very dangerous, by the way, folks. Do not do this. Do not do this. If you slipped and dropped the kid, you just run right over him. I don't know. I believe everything except the kid. The kid's surprisingly colorful.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. What do you think? Real, fake? And how would you know? What do you think, Nate?
I don't think I can tell.
Maybe that's...
No. I don't know why it would be fake.
Right. So yeah, that's my one. I don't know why it would be fake. And also, what is, if it is fake, what is the passenger in that car picking up in that child's place that they replaced with a kid?
Could be a small animal. Could be a loaf of bread. I think the thing that does make it a little more credible is at the very end when the mother comes and says, "Oh God," and grabs the kid away.
Jeez.
Jeez Louise, what are you doing?
I just feel like it would be much more like, if this was fake, I mean, you'd make it more exciting, right? You'd put him somewhere else.
But shouldn't the guy just get out of the car and help the kid back to the sidewalk?
Well, it's cold outside, Leo. Casey.
Very Russian. Very Russian.
That guy got out. He's like, all right, what's going on here? Here's my question. Wait, okay, so am I to understand that is, oh, he's the driver. Okay, so the driver is
on the right? No,
because this guy in the bus gets out and on our traditional driver's side, he is not correct. The driver. So I assume it's right-hand drive.
Oh, so maybe it's not Russia. Oh, you're right. He's not the boy. You're smart, Ashley. I didn't know he wasn't the driver, but you're right. Either he is not the driver or the car. He's lost control of the vehicle.
Yeah, the car is just a self-driving crappy little bus.
It is a little
feature on the new Tesla.
I paid for that. Yeah, if he bought it used, he paid for FSD for sure. It hasn't been deactivated yet.
All right. This happened in 2017. I don't know. Maybe the biggest story in tech this year was COVID, of course. But the effect COVID had on a little company very few people had heard of that suddenly became a generic term for video conferencing. I'm talking about Zoom. The world has changed. It's in so many unusual and interesting ways. Of course, a lot of people who weren't using Zoom all of a sudden are using Zoom, which is, I would guess, the number one video conferencing technology. Zoom says they went from 10 million daily active users in December to 200 million last month. And of course, as a result, we're seeing all sorts of problems.
First of all, that's crazy numbers, by the way, before we get into the problems.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, when have you heard of a platform going from 10 to 200 in a month?
Not since Facebook.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably the last time we've seen that type of growth, right? Would be Facebook, and even then, I don't know if you saw that uptick that quickly.
Yeah.
Potentially once they kind of hit their stride and were going to more and more places, maybe you did, like maybe once they really started investing in Asia and South America, but that's probably the last time we've.
How did Zoom win this? Like it seems like was Zoom the number one choice in business? I mean, what about Cisco WebEx or GoTo Meeting or Microsoft Teams?
It's ease of use. I think it is.
Yeah,
it's ease of use and it's relatively cheap.
Right.
Sorry, go on, Jason.
That's the problem, though, is it was so easy to use that's why they're running into these problems. And some of the people are saying that some of the fixes that they're trying to do now are going to be kind of shooting themselves in the foot, because even doing something simple like having a password to join a Zoom call is going to make it more difficult for people to use.
Yeah. Well, here's an interesting story. Zoom bombing is now a federal offense that could result in imprisonment. I don't know if that's reduced the number of Zoom bombs. Federal prosecutors are saying that if it was posted as a press release to the Department of Justice website under the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of some state, with support from the State Attorney General and the FBI, probably New York, I would guess that the most aggressive in something like this. Zoom bombing is a big problem for schools, for churches. I have a friend in a 12-step program, a recovery program, and of course they can't meet in person anymore. They do their meetings as Zoom meetings, and because they're public, of necessity, anybody can come in, and people are doing horrific, offensive, triggering things, not just pornography, not just racial epithets, but intentionally going after alcoholics, things like that. It's just appalling. And it's my understanding that a lot of the organizing is going on. I'm sure it's happening at 4chan, 9chan. Discourse is being used. There's a discourse channel for Zoom bombing where they share public IDs for Zoom events so that they can all have so much fun. It's just shocking, really, how awful some people can be.
Yeah, it's funny. My mom sent me an email. I guess this was maybe Tuesday this week, maybe Wednesday. We were, I think, in the middle of either the first or the second wave of Zoom scandals of the week. And her Bible study is going to be using Zoom, and she wanted to know. She was like, should I use this? Maybe I don't want to bother with it at all.
Yeah.
And so I sent her a detailed thing. I took the time to take the screenshots and go through the process. I was like, this is how you can join from your web browser. Just that's going to be your best bet. You know, don't sign up for an account. Don't do the other things. But I was really proud of her, A, for reading and keeping up on it, and B, asking, okay, what's the best way for me to
be
do
hard
this?
To miss the news. It's all over the place. Because everybody's using it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Definitely. But still, I'm still proud of my mom for wanting to know how can I mitigate it? Even asking the question, should I be using this? And part of me wants to be no, don't use this at all. And then another part of me is yeah, but I don't want you to miss out on being able to connect with people. You know, that's to me, I think the hard thing about having the advice to just be, don't use this product. If you're an enterprise or a school or something, I think that's one thing where maybe you should appeal to the higher authorities who make those decisions to say, have you actually vetted this? But if the decision's already been made and this is what your school is using or your Bible study or your, AA meeting or something else, if that's what they're choosing to do, it's a really, I think, not fair thing to say to regular people, well, just opt out of this. Just don't use this right. communications. It's the same thing when people say, oh, well, just don't be on Facebook, right. You know, where it's like, okay, that's really, that comes from a really privileged
it's
position to be
privilege.
Able to make that point.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
And the thing about Zoom, look, there's still lots of great things about Zoom. It's funny, we used to have, up until the last couple of years, I've even been saying really until the last 18 to 24 months when Zoom has kind of gotten much more popular, we used to have this joke for the last four or five years of, we've got self-driving cars, but we still can't get a video call to work and we still can't get a PowerPoint, And Zoom really has kind of solved that. It has gotten to where it's made these things easy enough that you can get a lot of people connected. I agree with Christina. People shouldn't be too freaked out about it. Obviously, the NSA shouldn't be using it for, and some companies that are doing corporate secrets. You saw SpaceX say that they're, they banned it. Well, that makes sense. They're dealing with highly proprietary and sensitive information, right? That deals with their core business. So, that makes perfect sense for the average people, stuff. I had a friend that yesterday, did their, on their Zoom, they did a their sister's baby shower and it was amazing. And she talked about the fact that, what it's enabling them to do. And I did this wonderful organization called Interfaith Paths to Peace, because a lot of, a lot of religious organizations, they don't really have tech departments. And so this organization has helped sort of provide a platform using Zoom where people of different faiths can come together and, have fellowship and be able to worship together and get inspiration. So there's great things that are going on with Zoom. The thing where the onus is the people who are hosting these meetings, they just need to implement a few good things. Brian mentioned the password thing, which now Zoom is kind of imposing. You can still send somebody a Zoom link with that password essentially embedded in that link. And so it makes it easy for them to just click and join. But if somebody's doing that random looking, typing in random Zoom numbers or finding, random Zoom rooms to jump into, they can't get in if they don't have the password. And even then, if you set up a waiting room, the host of a Zoom can help kind of screen people. And if they see people that are jumping in and are being inappropriate, you can hit the remove or, jump them back to the waiting room if for some reason it's somebody you don't recognize. So there's plenty of ways to mitigate this for most people that are using Zoom. It's just that the people who are using it and were considering using it to do very proprietary things, they obviously need to think twice about it. But by the same token, it's still better than we used to do these calls where, you have your number, you dial into an 800 number and then you put in your corporate sort of number 9-digit ID. Well, the thing is, we never knew who was on those calls. With Zoom, at least right. You can see who is on there. And so it is generally even more secure, even as insecure as it is right now, the problems it has with encryption and those kinds of things, it's still a step up from the average conference call.
But my question is, because, you know, we've been talking about consumers using this, but the question that I have is, you know, usually you see problems like this when you have a consumer product try to move into enterprise. This is an enterprise product that's suddenly being used by consumers, right. But there are all these security issues. Where were the CIOs and CTOs? Where was everybody like checking out all of the security problems that Zoom had before this?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I actually disagree. I disagree with Zoom. Zoom says that they were an enterprise product that is now being used by consumers. I will say I think that's patently false, and I think they're being misleading when they say that. They may have had some specific enterprise, you know, implementations, like apparently they have one for HIPAA, but the vast majority of the times that I was using Zoom was either for small teams things. I saw a lot of startups using it, individuals kind of wanting an easy way to set up conferencing systems, or hobbyists, you know? So I think that really most of their users before this were small businesses, startups, maybe medium-sized business, places that don't have CIOs and CTOs that are going to be looking.
Yeah, the big businesses had WebEx. They would use the big Cisco conferencing systems, much more expensive, much more complicated, but better quality.
I don't think it was. Yeah, exactly. It's very much like Slack in that sense. And a lot of people use Slack and Zoom together. And so I actually reject their statement that it was enterprise, because I don't think it was. If it was enterprise, to your point, Brian, we wouldn't have seen some of these things, because that would have been a complete, like, you know, breaker. What I think has happened, though, is that as there were companies, even big companies, that might not have had solutions that worked for this number of people, like one of the big, frankly, like the secret sauce of Zoom, not just its ease of use, but also its quality and its relative ease for having very large groups of video chat working together in a way that WebEx and some of the other solutions just can't do. And to my knowledge, they're still the only, you know, solution where you can see kind of everyone's video at once in that kind of style. And I know that some other products are working at bringing that type of feature up, but they're the only one who does it
there's a great open source solution that I use called Jitsi.
Jitsi.
Yeah.
And I set up in about 10 minutes, I set up a Jitsi server at home.
How many people can you do with that? Because I've heard that it really caps out around 12 or 13. And so that would be my only like remark, because I'm talking about people who might need like 20 or more.
It depends on bandwidth that you have available to it. It can do 100 people easily. In fact, I've seen bandwidth tests with Jitsi. It's very light on the CPU usage. It's really about bandwidth. The thing to remember with any service is, for a video service to work, especially in the way you want, where you have the grid of people, you have to have it unencrypted at the server side. And so when Zoom says it's end-to-end encrypted, that's not in the same way we understand end-to-end, which means no one can see it except the participants. Zoom can see it. Jitsi's the same way. It's encrypted, but at some point the server needs to coordinate, so it needs to be unencrypted. But the beauty is Jitsi is it's open source. You can run your own server. I am, and then it is fully private. There's no one can see it. It has some of the same problems Zoom would have. You still have to set up a password if you want to protect it, and that's the big problem for churches, for schools, maybe not so much schools, but certainly for churches and recovery groups and groups that want to be public. You can set up a waiting room. You can do all sorts of things, but ultimately you can't lock it down, because you want anybody who be able, you know, who wants to come to the meeting, come to the meeting. And so that's the problem people are having. And that would be the same problem with, I think, any service.
I first hated Zoom months ago
when they had that problem, and a security researcher warned them about this with malware. They installed on the Mac a web server, a hidden web server that would run all the time on your Mac. Their idea was, of course, that you should be able to just click a link and Zoom would launch. But this hidden web server did not go away when you uninstalled Zoom. It stayed there, again, so that even if you uninstalled Zoom, you click a link, Zoom behind the scenes does what it needs to do to get a thing going. And hackers discovered it and started using it to inject malware into Macintoshes. Zoom had been warned about this, dragged their feet fixing it. Apple finally had to push out a fix on their own. Apple actually had to push out a malware fix on Macintoshes because Zoom wouldn't fix it. Now, Zoom says, you know, in their credit, I guess, that they're going to stop. They said this week, they're going to stop working on new features. Everybody on the Zoom team is going to work on privacy and security features. So I guess the proof will be in the pudding. But I lost faith in Zoom when they claimed end-to-end encryption when that wasn't yep. the case, and when they didn't fix the server problem. And of course, then there have been other reported issues. The iOS version sent data to Facebook because they used a Facebook SDK. Zoom stopped doing that. But they only seem to stop this stuff after they get caught. They were routing yeah. calls through a China call center. They said, oops, we did that because we were so loaded up. Oops, we won't do that anymore. I don't know. I'm not against Zoom. By the way, we use it for all our sales calls. I've tried to get Lisa. I said, you know, I have this great Jitsi server. You could use this. It even has our brand in the name because I set up a domain for it. Said, nah, Zoom. Everybody knows Zoom. Everybody knows Zoom. And it's hard to get people to use something else. So I'm hoping Zoom will step up. There's an opportunity here for them to step up.
I'm hoping they are too, but I'm with you. Look, when the thing happened last summer with them installing the web server, and honestly, it was the response to that that really bothered me more than it was even the act itself. Yes. That initially they barred the security researcher, they wouldn't communicate, they tried to kind of sweep it under the rug, say that it wasn't a big deal, and then once they were properly chastened, they had a belated apology. And the whole thing put a bad taste in my mouth. And
it was very Facebook-y.
Very much, you know, so.
And move fast, break things, apologize later, then keep doing it.
And our team had been using Zoom. And after that, we were like, we're done. We're not using this anymore. And so I was done with it then. But if someone else wants to use it for something, I'm not going to be like zealous about like, oh, I refuse to use the system you want to do. What bothers me now, though, and this is the thing that bothers me from all the different issues they've had, is that I think that one of the reasons that we're seeing this is because they've gone from 10 million to 200 million users. Yeah. So they're getting an outsized amount of attention. And I think if you put this attention on any sort of service, you would see, you would also be able to find flaws, right? But the thing that bothers me is that they have this amazing differentiator. In the IRC right now, we're kind of all talking about how the system hasn't changed in 22 years and they're all terrible. And that's basically true. Zoom has been the first thing that works really well. It's easy to set up. I think the reason you saw businesses, enterprises who maybe normally would have gone through a stronger vetting process, not go through that process, is they suddenly had to be remote for the first time and needed to support a large number of people and just started with it, right? So I think that's another reason why it's had so much adoption. But they have this huge differentiator. They are easy to use. It's well done. It has good features. It's high quality. That's something that is a massive differentiator. And rather than using that as the selling point, and rather than using that as what they want to focus on, everything that they've done, it seems like, has been in, you know, search of like sort of growth hacking and kind of cutting corners. And it makes me question a lot of fundamental things about the company. I love the product, but I'm not, to be totally honest, I'm not convinced by even the latest blog post that the CEO put out. I don't really feel like I believe anything. I don't feel like they have proven themselves to be trustworthy, which is so disappointing because this is genuinely a product that is head and shoulders ahead of the competition. And I feel like they're squandering a lot of this by ways to growth hack.
A lot of the things that make Zoom good, Jitsi does. For instance, Jitsi uses a more modern protocol, WebRTC, which means you don't have to install any software. If you're using Chrome, it's just a link,
right,
and it does it in Chrome without any additional software. And that's really nice. That really is easy to use.
And I look, in Jitsi, that's great. I think if we're being honest, the setup process of people getting started with Jitsi Meet, whether they use that service or set up their own instance.
You don't have to set up anything. I could send you a link right now and you could use it in your browser. No setup. You're just in. That's pretty easy.
Right. But I mean, like if you're a business and you want to set up your own instance is what I meant. Like if you wanted to control.
Yeah, but you don't have to. Like they offer a free version. And honestly, if you've got Debian running or any Debian derivative running, it's a simple apt install Jitsi Meet. You're done. It does. Let's encrypt automatically. You're done. It was so easy for me to set up. It was trivial. I agree. Many businesses aren't going to want to do that, but you don't have to do that. I could set up. Watch. I'll send you a link right now. You can try it. Go to Twitter.
I would be cautious about whether Jitsi could support 200 million daily active users.
Should we see? Let's see. twit.team/twit. Let's just see. I'm going to set it up. Secure connection failed. Uh-oh. Maybe not. Never mind. We'll do this another time. I don't know what happened there.
I think one of the things we have to also take into account, you know, there's a lot of self-inflicted wounds on Zoom's part, to Christina's.
Yeah, but that's the question is it accidental or are these guys nefarious? As Bruce Schneier said in his post, the errors that Zoom has committed fall into three broad practices: bad privacy, bad security, bad user configurations. That doesn't sound like ineptitude. That's starting to sound a little bit like.
And there's a fourth, too, because they were sort of leaving doors open to do tracking and things like that. Yeah, they were as well.
Well, because they had a free tier and they wanted to monetize the free tier. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So go ahead, Jason.
I think that the comparison to early Facebook is especially, I think, poignant because of it was very much like you say, move fast, break things, innovate, create a great product, and you apologize later when we make some mistakes. Not a great business model. I think, you know, Facebook is finally feeling the pain of that from a user standpoint, and it's likely to, although there has been some indication that some of the people who've left Facebook are going back during this time, but also people have a ton of time on their hands. So, you know, I don't know if I'd take that as a long-term power,
well, this is, move. For geeks, so this is for all of us a question. Because this is not an unusual conundrum for geeks. We know better. We know that this isn't a good idea. We know what's wrong with it. We know in great detail what's wrong with it. And yet, I mean, we had a family meeting on Friday, and I tried to use my server, my Jitsi, and one member couldn't get it working, so we went back to Zoom. For geeks, it's easy to say, oh, yeah, here's all the reasons. But as you said, Christina, it's hard. And Zoom just works. It's the other side of 5G's causing COVID. It's just It's just more noise.
Of all the crazy nonsense that I've heard, linking 5G to COVID is probably the strangest and the dumbest.
I think what you have to do is you have to think what is the psychological reason for that, and it's. Like Ned Ludd, it's, you know, the modern times are causing the COVID. What's the most modern thing in my neighborhood? Oh, it's that 5G tower.
Yeah, but I mean, people in the UK, we've had 20 5G towers burned down in the UK at the moment. I mean, it's just the rank.
But there's a psychological thing. It's not, you know what, I don't feel like people are rational. People are not rational. They act emotionally and then use reason to justify the emotional thing that they chose.
I fear your wiser head may be right on that one, but I got to say, when you've got a bunch of D-list celebrities going, oh, well, you know, 5G might be the cause. No, it bloody is. It's just like, you know, it's like saying can openers are a cause of botulism.
It's obviously nutty. I wonder even if the people who are destroying the towers feel the same way, but it's just so satisfying.
We see, at first I thought it was like kids under lockdown, go out, do a bit of vandalism, make yourself feel better. Fair enough, it's a British tradition. But when you actually get...
Because it's not happening in other countries as much, is it? I don't think we've had any 5G vandalism here.
A few cases in Europe, but other than that, fine. But, you know, if 5G really was the cause of this, you'd expect the highest... outbreaks of coronavirus in 5G areas like Finland, where they've had one
death. It's patent nonsense. It's obviously nonsense.
No. So I always like to figure out why. So, like, what was...
Yeah.
What is it that people are seeking in this? And I think it comes back to certainty. There's a problem with having too much data. Sometimes too much data is bad, and sometimes not enough data is bad. Too much information is sometimes bad. Not enough information is sometimes bad. That is the current situation that we are living in. And I think with 5G, which is kind of like difficult to actually understand, I think the problem is you have some people with too much of the wrong information and then a whole bunch of people with no information. There's no center ground where cooler heads prevail.
Yeah. And also cooler heads don't make great headlines. You know, no. I mean, it's shame. There's a British paper called the national paper called the Daily Express, which used to be a very good paper, but is now all about asteroids and, you know, conspiracy theories and the rest of it. My gran used to read that, you know, and took it as gospel. you know, we do have this information overload that we're, you know, and people are just like, well, I read it on the internet. And we need to teach media savvy to people, just to, with anything that you read, who wrote it, why did they write it, and who paid for it to be written? Those are the three key questions you have to ask.
All right, I want to make two columns. It's like tired and wired, but it's not. It's like pre-COVID, post-COVID, or no. So, for instance, no malls. Co? Malls. Pre-COVID, there were malls. Post-COVID, no malls.
Amazon.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's like 100 shopping malls that are due to close over the next month or so. The numbers are staggering.
They're not coming back.
No, permanently.
No.
Yeah.
Sad to say, a lot of restaurants are gone, won't come back, right? Because they're out of business. Anything that was hanging by a fragile thread, that thread's being cut right now, right? Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, our local Indian place they've seen their takings drop by 80%. It's the same with every other restaurant. I have to an apology for British listeners at the moment, but I went to get my this may cause amusement. I meant to get my growler filled at the local pub. Now, for American listeners, growler, it's the bottle that you fill your beer up with.
Yeah.
British listeners, it's something rather rude. So
you took a growler to a recently. There's no way they would have put beer in that.
He's doing his bit. A lot of beer is going stale in the barrels. We need you to drink more beer, Ian.
Our local brew pub sells growlers for 2 hours a day. So this may cause amusement for British friends, but a nice young man filled my growler with his fat pipe.
Drive-in movies making a comeback, right? We can all sit in our cars. Roll up the windows.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, remember in 1965, I'm old enough to remember going to the New York World's Fair, and AT&T had a video phone. They said, by 1970, we'll all be using video phones. And I remember in 2001, in 1977, the movie 2001, he's on the moon. He's talking to his daughter and his wife on Earth via a video phone in a video phone booth. And it never took off. All of a sudden, we're all making video calls. I think this might have been the impetus to finally get us over the hump, because we didn't want to. I think people didn't want to, but now they're making video calls, and I don't think we're going to stop. I think that this is that's something that's changed dramatically.
I mean, I think within the IT industry as well, one of the big changes is going to be conferences, because conference season
it's over. Conferences are over. I'm not going to CES ever again.
Well, I mean, CES at the end of the year. Okay, sorry, Amy, please.
Conferences are not over for a couple of very practical reasons. The first of which is that humans are social. So there is no way people are going to opt for no gathering or a virtual gathering over an in-person gathering. It might take a year for us to get back into the swing of things. But to me, this is a little analogous to after 9/11, when everybody said nobody's going to fly again. We have to sort of wait it out to have the new protocols and for people to feel confident. And then everybody's going to be back on planes.
Is anybody going to go on a cruise ship ever again?
Well, that's you. You're the one who cruises.
Yeah.
You tell us.
I was talking yesterday with Johnny Jett, our travel guy, and his thesis was you're not going to see widespread air travel or cruise travel or maybe even conferences until we have fast universal testing, so that you can go to the airport 5 minutes early, get a swab or spit in a vial, get tested. If you pass, you can board the plane. If not, you can't. It was hard to pick just one. But I think the weirdest story this year about Elon was the name he picked for his new child and how to pronounce it. Watch. So let's see. I keep wondering if there's going to be any tech news. You know, each week I go, are we going to have anything to talk about? Thank God Elon Musk exists. XAEA12. Can't really be the name of the kid. Elon Musk and Grimes have had a baby. They had a son on Monday. Elon tweeted out that strange name. Joe Rogan asked him on Thursday, how do you say the name? Musk says the name's pretty much pronounced X-Ash-A-12. A-E, some speculated, was actually Ash. It's a leaded A and E, some languages have, and it's often pronounced Ash. Musk said, first of all, Grimes is the one that came up with the name. It's just X, the letter X. Grimes in her tweet said, it's the unknown. X. A-E is pronounced Ash, so obviously the kid's name is Ash, right? You're going to, just the rest of it is extra. And then A-12, Elon said, is my contribution. The A-12 stands for the Archangel 12, the precursor to the SR-71, the Blackbird, which was this Phantom spy plane, right? The coolest plane ever, Elon said. If you want to hear Musk say it, he says it 37 seconds into Joe's show. Elon did not toke up on the show, though, I think, right? Not this time. Holy cow. Learned his lesson.
Good.
Anyway, thank you, Elon, for giving us something to talk about. That's Twit for the week. Thank you, everybody. Goodbye. No. I think, and you know, the timing is good because we got nothing else to do. This might be the most important week in computing in this century for sure. Perhaps, I don't know, perhaps, I can't think of another time with even the Mac transition to Intel, I don't think was this important. And of course, what I'm talking about is the Worldwide Developers Conference kicked off on Monday. It was going all week. I'm sure that's all you guys have been doing all week long, which is why you're here to fill me in. I did watch the keynote and the State of the Union, which is the more techie kind of follow-up they did on Monday. We even streamed both of those with commentary. And then I've been reading incessantly ever since, even to the point where I downloaded Xcode, the Xcode beta, picked up, I think I started the Stanford CS193 course in iOS development and started to dig into Swift UI, because I think we are going to enter a new era of computing. And here's you tell me, you guys could talk me down and say I'm full of it. But my thesis is we certainly began a new era of computing in 2007 when the iPhone came out. We didn't know it at the time, but that was going to transform computing. All of a sudden, the vast bulk of computing is now done on a thing that's in your pocket. It's always connected to the internet. It's omnipresent. Social media, Facebook and Twitter began on the desktop, but really wouldn't be as powerful as they are without the smartphone. That transformed everything. And Apple became, as a result, the most valuable company in the history of the world, now worth close to $1.5 trillion. They have hundreds of billions of dollars of cash. They're a behemoth, a juggernaut. The iPad, which had a lot of promise 10 years ago, didn't really seem to take off. But what I think I didn't fully appreciate, I'm sure you guys did, but what I didn't fully appreciate is that from day one of the iPhone coming out, Apple was preparing for something different. As certainly once they realized how successful the iPad was, Apple started preparing with their own chips. They started moving to technologies like metal. They started to do a lot of things that's really accelerated over the last couple of years with things like Catalyst to move into a new world of computing, an ecosystem they could utterly dominate. And that with the announcement that they were going to finally abandon an architecture that's been around since the 70s, x86, 1974, x86, and move to Apple Silicon. This was for me, the piece that went, oh, click, and the whole thing seemed to come clear to me. We're in a transformational moment. Am I nuts, Dan Morin?
No, not at all. I think this is a big deal from the perspective because, I mean, the iPhone in the earliest days, they were still sort of figuring out where it was. But once they started rolling out their own processors, I think it was only a matter of time. And increasingly in the last several years, as they put their own processors in like the Apple TV and the HomePod and the Apple Watch, you started to step back and say, why isn't this in the Mac? Why is the Mac now the only device they make that is running on somebody else's processor when they have done all this amazing work? Because we would keep seeing when the phones came out,
you know, they'd be benchmarking them and these things would be off the charts and you'd be comparing them against laptops and you'd be like, why this chip in a phone is outpacing this laptop that costs twice as much and is supposedly like this really powerful device they make. Why can't they bring that ability over to the Mac side as well? And I think Apple has shown time after time that they love controlling the whole hardware, the software, everything, the whole device, because they can optimize it to do exactly what they need it to do. And I think that it is fundamentally a huge change, obviously, for the Mac, but it really only solidifies something that we've seen with the iPhone and the iPad over the last decade or so. And, you know, famously, I think they, you know, originally started out wanting to build something like the iPad, and the iPhone ended up being kind of a diversion along the way, which is, you know, of course, hilarious because it's a huge, huge portion of their money now. But yeah, I think that now that they're putting everything they run on their own custom silicon, I think we've just dipped our toe into what is going to be an enormous change for the Mac. And that's saying something for a platform that's undergone so many transitions in its history.
I think it speaks a lot to not just the future of Mac, but the future of computing in general, because if Apple is going to be doing, if they're going to be competing in this space, in this processor chip space, Intel has to do something to match that so that PCs can build, you know, into the future as well. And this could also really just be a huge improvement for Microsoft and, you know, all the other chip makers, all the other processor manufacturers out there to like step up your game, because now Apple's in the business too. So you don't get to just sit back and be the kings of this realm because somebody's coming to take your throne, you know?
What happens to Intel, Jason? Is it curtains?
I really do wonder about that. You know, it's not necessarily a fait accompli that, you know, Intel will need to step up its game. We've seen Microsoft experimenting with Windows on ARM processors repeatedly. They're back there again now. And, you know, maybe it's definitely possible. If I was Microsoft, I'd be looking at this and thinking, I want to do what Apple did.
Uh-huh.
Maybe not, you know, with Qualcomm, let's say, uh-huh, or somebody like that. Like, why don't we redefine this and get away from Intel? Because Intel isn't doing... You know, Intel isn't working for us either. So I do think it's really hard. This is, you know, the lesson that Steve Jobs learned and then put in Apple's culture from a very early point is don't rely on other people for your critical business infrastructure. And, you know, Intel was a convenient tool for Apple to get out of the PowerPC Alliance and get computers that were actually running at decent speeds when the PowerPC Alliance was lagging. But, you know, the iPhone, because it wasn't a computer, they got to rewrite the rules. They ended up developing their own processors for it. And, you know, they've been thinking all this time, you know, what if we could apply this to the Mac? What if we could get away entirely from being on, you know, because I would wager that a lot of people's frustration with Apple's release schedule for a lot of their Macs the last decade has been because Apple was waiting for Intel.
You bet.
And
you bet.
Intel has had a really bad decade. So this is like the logical, I think, conclusion of what Apple learned from the iPhone, which is, you know, they built essentially the best chip design group in the world. And why would they not press their advantage? And I now suspect that the last two or three years of sort of static Mac development is because Apple's been too busy redesigning their next wave of Macs when they can control all of the parts.
You know, I swore that before this show, I would sit down and watch all 6 hours of testimony, and I just couldn't bring myself to do it. But I'm sure you all did,
yeah,
with a fine-tooth comb. So what are the takeaways?
Go ahead.
You start.
No, I was just going to say my takeaway is that they gathered an extraordinary bit of evidence. Leo, if you ran Twit and had as little information as these CEOs seem to have about Amazon,
I don't know anything about
Google,
that.
Well,
I don't
right.
Know.
I mean,
if we did that, that would be wrong. Right. But I can't promise we didn't do that.
What's happening here?
Yeah.
No, they it really seemed to be them repeatedly This was the pattern. The government would be talking out some emails that have them dead to rights on some anti-competitive behavior, something that was just completely indefensible. And they'd be like, oh, gosh, I just don't know anything about that. I guess I think what we were trying to say is we're trying to empower users. And they just kept trying to flip it around. Like the other part of it that was so stunning is all four of them really kept talking about their companies like they're these nimble, humble upstarts that just may have made a few mistakes. And it's like, y'all just beat the market repeatedly because you're all effectively monopolies or duopolies. Like, you know, you're not this nimble, like garage run company anymore. You are real entities. And I just, I really thought Congress did a pretty good job, all the grandstanding, put aside.
And it's the staff as much as anything else. I mean, they clearly did a lot of document. Are they able to use the power of discovery? Can they subpoena documents? Is that because they got a lot of internal emails?
Yeah, they released a lot of documents at the beginning of the hearings so that they could discuss a lot of emails and other things that were, I don't know, totally new.
For instance, emails that said internal Facebook emails that said, oh, we're really worried about Instagram. It's a real threat. Right before they bought it, confirming what everyone knows, which is that they bought it as a defensive action. Jamie Raskin got Bezos to admit Amazon are priced below market.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I always assumed that Amazon probably figured we'll make it up in the transactions that'll go through us as a result. Same thing with the Fire tablets. But I guess it's the problem is from an antitrust point of view, how do you compete with something that's priced below the cost to make it?
They also proved in the hearing that Amazon actually ranks its products up in Alexa above other products that are offered.
Again, so, something everybody who's used it knew, but it's good to get confirmation. It wasn't just your instinct. They accused Amazon. Actually, this was the PopSocket guy. And they brought this up, who accused Amazon of making duplicate products to his until he ponied up $2 million in ad buys. And then mysteriously, the Amazon version of the pop sockets disappeared. Jeff Bezos said, well, I don't know anything about that. If we did that, it was wrong.
Whoops.
I will say one thing that I found astounding, very interesting about this hearing is that it showed strangely that Mark Zuckerberg has been through a lot of these. He understood kind of how to play it.
Yeah.
He understood how to phrase his answers and respond in situations where he wasn't quite sure versus, say, Bezos, who has never been in this position before, floundered a lot.
Yeah.
I also, you know, maybe this is just me, but I'm looking at the kind of message that's sent by the way by the backdrops these executives had, the way they were shot. Bezos, for instance, and Ray, my Skype room, picked this up on Twitter. He said, get a ring light, Jeff. You've got them on sale right now at Amazon.com. Jeff was, and I think this was quite intentional. He was so poorly lit that he kind of blended into the background. And I think the intent was really to make him almost disappear. You know, he's managed to avoid these testimony up to now. It's just kind of in a nutshell, Jeff Bezos's way of handling all this is he doesn't give interviews. He doesn't testify. He just sits in the back, but he's definitely the puppet master. There's no question about that. He's pulling the strings. There will be. So the upshot of this, this is a big showpiece and members of Congress used it to grandstand, but there was a point, and the point is there will be a report from the subcommittee, a final report, which will probably not come out before the election. Six hearings, 385 hours of calls and meetings, and most importantly, 1.3 million documents from these companies. Lots of legwork done before this testimony. And I think the point of this report is, well, here's what we think should happen. Things like, I don't know what's on the table, maybe that Facebook should be required to divest Instagram and WhatsApp. That I'm almost certain will be one of the things they'll talk about. They did, talked to Sundar Pichai, CEO of Alphabet, and by extension Google, over a Google email saying some websites were getting too much traffic. Yeah. Did you get that email, Matt?
I don't recall getting that email. It's interesting because, like, I was there when the search team was like eight people around a ping pong table, and I always saw people acting with a lot of integrity and trying to make sure that the results were fair, they were nonpartisan. If somebody types in X, they get information or an answer about X. But I haven't seen that email. I'm wondering whether, it's also the case that if like eight out of the top 10 results are one site, then somebody could send an email that's like, oh, this site is dominating the search results in a way that's unfair. And then the shorthand might be this site is getting too much traffic. But I've personally seen where investigators can ask questions about things that to a search engineer, you're like, oh, these results are interesting. And then they're like, are they interesting because you are squashing a competitor? And they're like, no, they're interesting because it's actually got more French results than we would have expected, right, given that there aren't that many French queries, that sort of thing.
That's what makes it so difficult. Just the phrase getting too much traffic it's not a smoking gun. Now the imputation is this site was getting more traffic than our own sites, but it could absolutely just be a failure of, oh, the algorithm's putting this result up more than it ought to. Pichai's response was, Congressman, just like other businesses, we try to understand trends from data, which we can see, and we can use it to improve our products for users. That was, by the way, the drumbeat from all of them, but especially for Sundar Pichai, is we want to improve our products for users. I have to say, at the beginning, when all four gave their statements, I want to stand up and wave the flag. I want to say, yeah, God bless them. This is the engine of the American economy. This is what's moving us forward. This is where innovation is happening, that these companies are doing their best to make the best possible product. As Tim Cook said, I guess it's true, we aren't dominant in any field that we participate in. We are not even close to dominant. We just try to make the best products for users. And I think to some degree, to take the opposite side from you, Brianna, that's what these companies do. And I don't think they should be punished for doing it well.
Well, I would actually agree. I thought Tim Cook, I think if you wanted to rank who got master blasted in this hearing, I think Amazon would be number one. Facebook would be number two. I thought Google and Apple got off relatively unscathed.
Hardly talked to Tim, actually.
Yeah, I listened to most of the hearing while I was working. And, the biggest moment with Tim Cook was him being asked about cancel culture for some asinine reason. So I found Apple's answers generally compelling on this, as well as Google's. So I think I agree with you, Leo.
There'd be a risk for Congress to be too aggressive in this, because especially now, during COVID, we are really reliant on technology companies.
Yeah.
Is it the case, do you think, may I ask Paris this, is it the case that these companies are so big that we don't see the innovative ferment we used to see? I heard one of my colleagues say in the early days, there'd be hundreds of different products from hundreds of different companies. There was nobody one huge dominant player. We had so much to cover. Now it's really, we cover Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple, do you feel like that's true, Paris? Is that fair?
I mean, I feel like from a coverage perspective, yes, just because it is.
They're so dominant.
There are so many. They're so large. Each of them are a world in and of themselves, essentially. And there is a lot to cover within each company, much less all of them combined. I mean, do I think that translates directly to whether or not these companies are monopolies? It's not my position to say. But I think it's interesting and perhaps not the right framework to apply here when you're thinking about like a coverage perspective. I think that a coverage perspective is always going to be focused on the biggest players in the room, because right, there just isn't enough energy out there, much less funding in media or even just from users, to have your eyes on everything. But I think that also when you have companies that do get so large and do affect so many people, that warrants criticism and warrants a careful eye.
That's exactly what David Cicilline, who's the chair said, he said, because these companies are so central in our modern life, this was in his opening, their business practices and decisions have an outsized effect on our economy and democracy. Any single action by any one of these companies can affect hundreds of millions of us in profound and lasting ways. Absolutely. Nobody denies that. It's why we cover them. We cover because they change our lives. That's not inherently bad.
Yeah.
What do you think, Matt? I mean, you have the best perspective on Google having worked there. And I would agree with you. Everybody I ever met from Google had, just like Tim Cook, had the interest in making the best product they could.
Yeah, I think that's true. I also think way back, you know, the first like FTC investigation, like 2011 or whatever, you know, the thing that Google would say is, we understand that with size comes scrutiny. And I think given the size of all these companies, it is perfectly appropriate to scrutinize them. And at the same time, it was interesting to see how, if you think about like an earlier Zuckerberg hearing, the questions were not on point, as seen by Paris's hat, for example. And the questions, like you could tell a bunch of research happened. And for me, one of the most interesting things is how do you get like the idea of lawmakers passing laws to regulate technology when they might not perfectly understand some of the issues involved is a little bit scary. And so there's some interesting areas. There's this thing called Tech Congress, for example. They've got fellowship applications opening for the next 3 weeks. So they bring in technologists, computer scientists, engineers, and they sit in the offices of like important members of Congress to help make sure that people understand technology and you can ask the right questions or you can get to the issues that matter. And I think getting more technologists talking to DC and vice versa is probably good for both worlds.
One, I mean, Cicilline was kind of a bulldog and he bared down on this Google issue. And this is the one I really want to ask you about, Matt. The claim is that Google favorites its own content over other sites' content. Cicilline put it in, I think, a very nasty way. He said, why does Google steal content from honest businesses? And he was pointing at Yelp, which maybe not the most honest business I've ever heard of.
I think honest business is an oxymoron generally, but yeah,
they're all trying to. And Yelp, you know, I mean, let's face it, a lot of this scrutiny comes from Google competitors who are unhappy with Google's success, and whether in the EU or here, and Yelp's a good example, go, hey, guys, you really ought to look into this. This is something terrible. But it is the case that when you do a Google search, and Pichai said this is particularly in commerce, when you're looking to buy a product, that Google's going to surface shopping information. There's a lot of knowledge cards now. Used to be Google search results were just search results. Now there's the knowledge card and there's a lot more stuff. And a lot of it does have YouTube videos, YouTube, you know, Google shopping. Google's excuse is we're trying to give people the information they're looking for. We're trying to answer their question. Right, Matt?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think the people in the search team still believe that. They've internalized that. And I also think there's you know, tension, which is well deserved, because as Google moves up the value chain of delivering better and better answers, you know, there are some sites, you know, from my old world with SEO hat on where, you know, people would feel like you're taking a snippet from my site. And that's the thing that people really want to know, like how high is this celebrity is.
So they never go to the site because they got the information. That's a legit complaint.
It's a legit complaint and it's a valid concern on both sides. Like, well, okay, if you really, all you needed to know was, you know, how high Tom Cruise was,
right,
then, you know, maybe they're not going to stay on
your
site.
Do you mean how high or how tall?
How tall, sorry. Okay. He can be as high as he wants. He doesn't need to be tall. But then the flip side is, you know, the other day I was invoking my Google device and I was like, you know, tell me how to spell loquacious. And it just spells it right out. It doesn't point me to another website. So,
but that's what you want, you know, as the user. Yeah. That's what you want.
Yeah.
So I do have to say, as someone that watched most of this hearing, we're not just talking about things that show up in Google site results. Like some of the most explosive moments we're talking about for Google's own lyrics that show up on Android. And they had one particular company that put that out there. They actually put fake records in their lyrics. And, you know, Google was caught red.
Yeah,
exactly. Google was caught using that. So this isn't.
Well, but Google, okay, so this is more complicated because Google said, well, we didn't scrape it from Rap Genius. We hired a company that scraped it from Rap Genius.
Yeah, okay.
So it's not our fault. It's that company's fault. And I think, at least in Google's defense, they stopped doing that. But they did get caught red-handed.
Sure. Yeah. I'm just saying, I think it's a wider pattern of behavior that I think could be construed as anti-competitive. And in my opinion, if you're using a third-party person and they're doing something that blatant, I think your company should face sanctions in that case. So that's my opinion.
The problem is it's just so hard to figure out. I mean, I think it's a good defense. Well, we're just trying to give people the answer that they expect.
Another thing that came up at the hearing, which is based on an article written by a couple of my colleagues, the information is kind of the accusations that Google has used its Android platform and the amount of information it can kind of collect on how users using Android use apps in order to do research for its own applications. I think the situation that that my colleagues discussed in their article was in preparation for launching Google's own possible like TikTok competitor, they pulled data from Android about how people use TikTok on Android devices, which seems kind of like a conflict of interest there.
It's a jerky move, if true. So,
yeah, but and Amazon's accused of using retail data to figure out what products it should make. Mm-hmm. But I think every business in the world would do that, does that, right? We're trying to figure, I guess Amazon has a unique access to data that it wouldn't normally have. Is that why it's wrong?
Part of the issue is that if you listen to the complaints of small like first party sellers or third party sellers on Amazon, they say, oh, I have been making this unicorn themed hairbrush for 10 years, everybody loves my unicorn hairbrush. It's been doing so well. Then all of a sudden I see Amazon brand unicorn hairbrush appears top of the search results is the Amazon choice and nobody buys my unicorn hairbrush anymore.
That's a good complaint.
In situations like that, it seems, to be a fairly concerning practice of true.
This is the same problem I have with Google owning YouTube and Amazon selling stuff, is it mixes the two things together. If Google were just a search engine, it wouldn't be so much of a problem, except that it controls one of the number one deliverer of video content. So that kind of muddles the matter. Amazon, if it's going to do what it's due, shouldn't also be in the business of making these products because they have an unusual amount of information. I mean, face it, I bought this hygiene hand on Kickstarter, which shows that I'm an idiot because I paid too much for it.
Oh, I've gotten so many Instagram ads for that thing.
Same.
But the point is, the minute that this went on Kickstarter, 800 Chinese companies made an exact clone of it and sold it for a tenth the price.
Yeah.
So all my friends have cheap ones. I have the fancy one. It's just a piece of metal that you poke stuff with. It's not. It shouldn't be expensive. But the point is, they didn't need Amazon data to do that. That happens all the time.
Yeah.
I bought. Well, don't judge me, but I bought LED light up eyelashes.
Okay, please back up. What's the context for this purchase?
Yeah.
I don't know.
And what was the URL for that?
It was URL. Yeah, see? Yeah, and Matt understands. It was called the F-Lash, Interactive LED Eyelash.
Do you have a video recording of you wearing them?
Yeah, no. Well, I ordered them, and this was another Kickstarter. I have a problem with Kickstarter. As soon as it went on Kickstarter... this poor guy, Vietnamese guy, got undercut by 100 Chinese companies selling. I mean, they said, well, we can do that. There's nothing special about that.
Oh my God.
And so as a result, I didn't get my F-lashes for months, but everybody else at the party had them. So I feel...
Your lashes feel dark and unilluminated.
Yeah.
Wow.
I didn't even wear them. I thought, screw this. Aww. You know, it's not special anymore.
I tell you, you got everything you need for your own TikTok channel. I'm telling
you. You're ready.
You got the lashes.
Yeah. You should be just posting content of you unboxing all of your crazy Kickstarter things. Oh, my God.
Yeah. 3 months after it's been on the market for half the price.
In front of your Black Hawk helicopter.
Yeah. Oh, man. If I bought that, I probably would be a TikTok star for a moment or two. That'd be good. Just do that quick.
I get your point. I really do.
It's complicated.
It is complicated, and in this particular case, my husband does patent law, and I would, if someone were coming to me with this particular business plan, I would say, what you have in front of you is not novel in a way that it can be patented according to our laws, and you should understand that this is a business threat. That's reasonable. I do think that's a slightly different situation than than a company abusing their data to undercut competitors and threaten other companies, which is what came out in this hearing. So I think I really agree with you, Matt. The way forward is these are big companies. They deserve scrutiny. And I think you can never say often enough, you know who wasn't at this hearing today? It's Microsoft. We brought that case against them in the 90s, and they have been a pretty ethical company, generally speaking, in the three decades now.
So you would submit that the DOJ prosecution of Microsoft in the 90s was successful in that regard?
What I've heard from my friends that work at Microsoft over and over and over again is that fundamentally changed the culture.
Interesting.
And that there was more of an anything goes approach before then. And then they finally had a conversation where it had to go through legal. They had to have discussions if it was going to open them up to liability. So my opinion is this is all checks and balances, right? If the, not talking about Trump, but a generic president were to do something that was over the line, Congress checks them, that doesn't necessarily mean the presidency itself is corrupt. It's just a system meant to check each other.
Good point.
I think until we see stronger antitrust actions against against tech companies, I think they're going to feel free to just keep pushing the line harder and harder. So I strongly support this line of investigation.
There were There were a lot of big stories in 2020. We just covered a couple, which is Apple's move to its own chips. And of course, Washington, D.C.'s investigations of the tech giants. That's a story that won't end for some time. Part of that story, and it's a weird one, is the president and TikTok. This is one, I don't know if we'll ever see the end of this. Watch. So the president has wanted to ban a TikTok. He couldn't figure out a way to do it. But I think he's might have found a way with executive order. He's going to prohibit Americans from having any transactions with the parent company ByteDance starting September 20th. That means TikTok can't pay influencers. Advertisers can't buy ads. TikTok's response to that is, we will help influencers move to another platform. We will pay, it will make sure that everybody we owe money to gets paid before September 20th. The plan B, and it's very unclear because the president goes back and forth on this, is to have some American company acquire at least the American operations of TikTok. Microsoft's been negotiating to buy the Australian, American, Canadian, and I think UK rights to TikTok. They have until the 15th.
They'd rewrite it in .NET, and that'd be effectively killing it. That's
a clever plan. Give it to Microsoft.
Bill Gates has said it's a poison pill.
He did say that. I saw that interview. Yeah. Really good interview with Bill Gates, by the way. Highly recommend that. Where was that? I just saw it. Read it this morning. It was with Stephen Levy. Was it in Wired?
Yeah. You also have to remember that the way that the executive order was written, he knows you can't block it. And he doesn't even have the knowledge to understand how that would even be possible. So he's stopping financial transactions. The problem is the companies that he's trying to stop the financial transactions with own like 60% of the gaming landscape.
Yeah.
Or they have interest in 60%
WeChat of the gaming landscape. WeChat and Tencent. And the other problem is he had to declare a national emergency. So apparently TikTok is now a national emergency.
Oh, excellent.
Not COVID-19, not Russian efforts to influence the election. Sometimes I feel like maybe this is, I feel like there's a larger agenda from the White House. It has to do with the trade war. It has to do with pay no attention to Russia. No, I'm not celebrating the Chinese government. They're repressive. Yeah. What they've done to the Uyghurs is shocking and disappointing and, horrible. And there was some evidence that maybe TikTok was doing something to keep black creators down or to keep overweight people, although I see plenty of overweight people on TikTok now. So they clearly fixed that algorithm. I just don't see TikTok as that big of a threat. And I'm a little disappointed for the creators who found this incredible medium to make something really amazing. And I often even feel like maybe the president doesn't like the fact that he's being made fun of on TikTok and that TikTokers registered for his Tulsa campaign rally and didn't show up. And it seems to be personal. He says,
but it totally makes sense because, I mean, if you ban TikTok, those people will totally not go anywhere else. I mean, they'll stop. Remember with
Vine, Twitter closed Vine, and that became a lot of the huge YouTubers now.
Well, by the way, that's the other chilling story that Twitter is trying to get TikTok, which that's if the best thing to do if you want to kill TikTok, just give it to Twitter.
I know. Yeah, good thing Twitter never had anything like TikTok.
Ay, ay, ay. Actually, Twitter doesn't have nearly the money that it would take to buy TikTok. TikTok's going to be well over $30 billion if it is sold to Microsoft.
And the whole thing is interesting. Like, you could ban TikTok the same way that the Great Firewall bans Twitter and Facebook just by preventing the app from being downloaded and firewalling off the servers. But how do you, like, separate it out so that I'm on Canadian and American TikTok, you're on UK TikTok. Can we not see each other anymore? Yeah. Can we? But the data is stored somewhere else.
It's just unclear.
There's just so many questions that people who don't have no idea how software and services work seem to want to manipulate.
People have accused me of saying, oh, you're soft on China, you're giving a pass. And apparently there were big fights in the White House over that as well. But I just don't see TikTok as a threat. There are some serious threats that are being completely ignored from Russia on Facebook and Twitter that are just being downplayed and ignored, while TikTok seems to be the poster child for problems. And incidentally, it won't stop with TikTok. This is really about Chinese products and Chinese apps. And it's
about privacy. If you are really concerned about TikTok being able to track what U.S. citizens are doing, it's not just TikTok. It's Facebook. It's Twitter. It's Google. It's everybody who has a cloud presence.
Well, if you're worried about how it could be used by foreign actors to influence us, you're not stopping it on Facebook and Twitter. It's not the ownership of the company that matters. Anybody can use TikTok, Facebook, or Twitter to do that. You just have to game the algorithm.
Yeah. But that's that whole data repatriation thing we were talking about a while ago when countries like China and France started saying they wanted the data for their citizens stored on servers that were located within those countries. I think Australia and a couple other countries, because ironically, they didn't trust necessarily Chinese or U.S. servers because they didn't feel like they had their best, things like FISA warrants and things like that. They didn't feel like they had the best interests of their citizens in mind. And I think we're still going to see an upswell of data repatriation laws globally, but as time goes on.
It goes beyond that. And that is, a country can ask for the data on servers that are contained on servers in their country, in their territory.
TikTok stores American data in America and backs it up in Singapore, according to TikTok.
Yep.
That's all right.
And maybe
right?
Canadian data in the U.S. Like, it's very expensive to have an entire data center in every single country.
Yeah. And I also worry that at some point you're going to see the Chinese lose their patience. And there are quite a few American companies that do a lot of business in China, including Apple.
Apple is hard because, like, the hardware is such an important part of the economy of southern China. Like,
they couldn't
turn
that off.
To shut down Apple hardware would devastate Shenzhen and all the companies and all the workers there. But Apple services could be an easy target. And it is interesting because right now some people see a disparity. Like, China will not accept anyone saying anything about Chinese policy. Like, you saw when the NBA commented about Hong Kong or other people, they were furious. But it goes one way. They don't mind commenting on at all on how the U.S. Right. or Canada or other countries. And the same way, they get upset if Chinese services like Huawei or something are not allowed access into Western markets. But they have no qualms about banning Twitter and Facebook and all the services in China. And I think I forget who said it. It might have been Ben Thompson, because he lives in Taiwan. He's really smart about this, that we insist on viewing China from an American point of view, and we very seldom take the opportunity to look at America from a Chinese point of view.
Right.
Well, this is where it's heading. In 5 years, this is the fragmentation of the internet. This is what we've been talking about at Twit for the last decade, which is you've got the Great Firewall of China. They're doing that in Russia. They're doing that in Saudi Arabia. They're doing that in Venezuela. We now have a administration that wants to do the same thing
in
the United States.
Do we not want to have – I don't think it's right. I think we condemn those countries for doing that. It's bad for them and it's bad for the world. Do we want to have a Great Firewall of America?
That's where we're headed.
Actually, the reason we're here armed. Whoa. I didn't know the gun was loaded. The reason we're here armed.
A lot of Americans say that. Yeah.
is because you can't play Fortnite on iOS anymore or Android. It's hard to hit the camera. Let me just see if I can really. Yeah, we'll get there. Fortnite clearly was itching for a fight and decided to take this time to modify the in-app purchases on its app, both on iOS and Android, in order to get pulled down on both. At which point they released a video that oddly they had just ready to hand called 1980 Fortnite that may remind you a little bit of a video that we saw in 1984. People sitting watching a giant screen, a young woman with, well, it's not a sledgehammer actually, it's a unicorn hobby horse, and she's running away from the police. She arrives and tosses it through the screen, which smashes, and then Epic Games has defied the App Store monopoly. In retaliation, Apple is blocking Fortnite from 1 billion devices. Join the fight to stop 2020 from being 1984. Hashtag free Fortnite. They were ready. They also went to court, sought an injunction. They did the same thing to Google. They didn't have a video ready for Google. I don't know. Maybe they thought Google wouldn't pay any attention. You may remember that Tim Sweeney of Epic didn't put Fortnite on the Google Play Store at first, saying you should sideload it because we don't want to pay the 30%. Eventually, they gave in. Mike, is there legal merit in what Epic is doing? Will they prevail in court or can they?
It's a big hill to climb. That doesn't mean that they won't win. They might. But if I were taking odds on whether or not Epic would prevail, I would say they are unlikely to prevail. Though I was impressed. Not only did they have that 1984 video, they actually referenced 1984 in the complaint. So that their marketing and legal team.
It's a 60-page complaint. I don't think they wrote that overnight. No.
They had, but it's impressive. Not only did they have it ready, but that they had worked out with the marketing this whole framing.
Well, wait a minute. That's not though. I think that's part of it. In a way, that I think if I'm the judge, that's going to taint this a little bit because it's so clear that they kind of set this whole thing up, that they prepared for months for this moment.
And I mean, part of the thing that's interesting about it, I guess, is that, if you look at it from Apple's perspective, they were going to be in trouble no matter which decision they made, right? If they sort of let Fortnite get away with this, then everybody else would be complaining that, they're giving sort of special treatment to Fortnite. And then, of course, when they say, well, Fortnite is violating the rules, so therefore we're gonna pull them from the store, then they have all these other issues. So no matter which way it was going to go, like Apple didn't have any good choices. And I guess Google was picking sides and decided they were going to, realizing that if Apple loses, they're going to be in trouble too.
Yeah. Apple, of course, is already under the gun in the EU over App Store monopoly. In the United States, Tim Cook was brought up in front of Congress along with three other executives, as a couple of weeks ago. And that was one of the issues that Congress was interested in. The antitrust subcommittee will have a report, probably not till the end of the year or early next year, about this. But there's some concern. The FTC is looking into it. that maybe Apple is monopolistic. And then on the other hand, and I'll give this argument so you guys don't have to, a lot of people I know say, hey, Apple, it's as if Apple built a great mall and Forever 21 moved in and said, well, but we don't want to pay you any rent. We just want to be in your mall. They're freeloading, Epic's freeloading on what Apple has built with its platform and its store. Do you agree, Amy? Does that seem reasonable?
Yeah, so this is, there's a couple of things happening here. One, we don't have a clear definition for what the future of distribution would look like. So what's interesting about, I think it's interesting that Epic is trying to initiate an antitrust battle, because the hearing that happened a week ago or 2 weeks ago reflects lawmakers sort of scrambling to, first of all, group together companies that really are doing disparate things. And second of all, using policy that was written in 1890. So the Sherman Act was written.
Didn't really know about app stores.
Right. But this is important because there's very little substantive analogy to make about the means for distribution in a digital setting and the railroad system. So that being said, this is an interesting, this could be an interesting and possible, possibly the only way to really crack through. And that's because this is a limited circumstance. So Apple charging 30%, if you look at other industries, that percentage of rev share is higher than what you would see elsewhere.
It's not, though, higher than on the consoles. Sony, Microsoft, and Nintendo charge the same 30% fee and have the same control. This all dates back to the days when Atari and Nintendo were swamped by crappy games, and they learned very early on, hey, we got to keep tight control over what's on our console. Fortnite doesn't seem to mind that 30%.
No, it's the data on the other end. So the key difference here is that when you've got a console game with heavy DRM protections, you know, you're talking about a limited use case. Now with a game being on a different type of device, one that hinges on the Play Store and Apple Store, there's a wealth of other data there. And so I think if they were, it really depends. If they try to define antitrust very narrowly, I think they have a shot. I think it could be more compelling for them to talk about the future of all of this data that's being generated, and the fact that in and of itself is also, you know, that has value. And they can't easily access those data in addition to having to pay the fees. And you can't, you know, there is no other way to play Fortnite. You either have to jailbreak and, I guess, somehow.
That's true. On Google, you could sideload, but there's nothing you can do on Apple. Right.
So I think Google had, I don't think I have as strong of a case against Google, but the reality is that Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Apple are all facing some flavor of antitrust, and the blanket application we already know doesn't apply. So what's interesting here is Epic could force the hand of Apple and start to change parts of the industry.
What is the, so Apple's response to this, by the way, let me paraphrase it, is this is disingenuous of Epic. They've had apps on our App Store for 10 years. They've benefited from their presence on the App Store for 10 years. Now, Apple says Epic's business interests lead it to push for a special arrangement that would be unfair to other developers. Whose reputation is more at risk here, Epic's or Apple's? Ian?
Honestly, I think this is a really interesting case because, I mean, let's face it, you don't get Fortnite because it's on the Apple Store. You get Fortnite because it's a really good game. And Apple has said they run a closed ecosystem. If you want apps on our phones or on our hardware, you have to go through us. And that seems blatantly anti-competitive. I admit I'm a foreigner over here, but even so.
Why does that have anything to do with anything?
Well, I mean, not knowing quite how
what are antitrust laws?
Your antitrust
they're different. Work, but, I've been told, Mike's probably more an expert on this than I am, but they're different in the in the EU than they are here in the United States.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. You would not get away with this in the EU. But I mean, US regulators are very much the sort of, oh, well, do whatever you like and we'll issue a minor fine. Honestly, I'm with Epic on this one. And yes, Apple sleptwalked into this. You know, they walked right into an ambush. They had the Epic had the trailer ready to go. They had the lawsuits ready to go. This was done around about the time that Apple was facing antitrust talks in Congress. This was a hit job, pure and
although
simple.
If I'm a Fortnite player, I might be pissed off on the one hand because we know Tim Sweeney personally made $7 billion last year from Fortnite. The Epic made even more. So it's not like they're hurting. Giving Apple their 30% hasn't hurt them.
Well, no, but it's the principle of the thing, surely. I mean, yes, okay. Apple says if you want to run software on our phones, you have to give us 30%. That seems to me to be anti-competitive.
So this year we really had the pleasure of talking to one of my favorite people. He's a great science fiction author. He's a deep thinker, and he's an advocate for privacy, security. Cory Doctorow. Cory had some really great things to say in our episode that we did with Cory and another one of my favorite guests, Amy Webb. He talked about, well, it's his term. I'll let him explain, the chickenization of America. By the way, I want to recommend people read your post went up this week on 10 on Medium, 10.medium.com, How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism, which is it's a prescription, in effect, for how to fix this issue. And it's easy for us to see that the dominance of a handful of companies is a problem. It's a lot harder to think of how you fix that. They're not going to go easily. Government, our government, at least in the United States, is run by money. So, of course, the biggest companies. In fact, that's Larry Lessig, remember, wanted to eliminate DRM. But he realized that's never going to happen unless you change how political financing works. So he changed his goals. He said, well, first we got to fix money, the problem of money in government.
So there's another copyright scholar, colleague of Larry's, a guy named James Boyle from Duke University, who has a really good riff about this, which is that before the term ecology was coined, there were people who cared about like owls and people who cared about the ozone layer. And while they didn't like hate each other, they didn't really see themselves as fighting in the same fight. They were issue-based campaigners. And the term ecology said that like, yes, you're interested in owls and I'm interested in the ozone layer, but what we're both fighting for is ecology. And it took, you know, 1,000 different issues and turned it into a movement with 1,000 ways in. And movements get stuff done. And so in terms of monopoly and like its opposite pluralism, which is why, you know, these days I'm at pluralistic.net, in terms of monopoly, there are people who are really worried about monopoly, even if they don't care about tech. And they don't know it, but they're all on the same side. Like, you know, I take off my glasses and it says made in Italy because they're Oliver Peoples glasses. And Oliver Peoples is a subsidiary of a company called Luxottica, which has bought every single eyewear brand you've ever heard of, as well as LensCrafters, Target Optical, Sears Optical, the major lens manufacturer and insurer.
Sunglass Hut.
Yeah, they own Oakley. They own Versace. They own every brand you've ever heard of. They've raised prices 1,000% in 10 years. If you need prescription glasses, you care about monopoly, even if you don't know it yet. And then, like, you know, people who watch John Oliver, they know
that. It is really like the frog in the boiling water because, yeah, I pay $700 for my glasses now when I only paid $150 10 years ago. But it kind of went up gradually, so I didn't really notice. And I certainly didn't know it was Luxottica's fault.
But there's a lot of people who have more urgent causes, right? Like if you're a pro wrestling fan, then you might have noticed in the last couple of years that all the wrestlers you love are begging on GoFundMe for money to pay their medical bills so they can die with dignity in their 50s from their work-related injuries.
Oh my God.
Because Vince McMahon bought all the other wrestling leagues. Right. There used to be 30. Now there's one. He's reframed all of his workers as contractors, and he took away their health insurance. Yeah. And so wrestling fans also have common cause. And it's like ozone layer and owls, right? There were people who cared about the ozone layer. They didn't really understand what was going on with the owls. They knew that there was something really bad going on with the ozone layer. When they heard about the owls, they're like, that's really alarming, but I'm focused on the ozone layer. And it wasn't until we got into ecology rather than issues that people were able to say, we're all fighting for the same thing. And like, even though the way I'm fighting for it is by working on the ozone layer, I'm going to support the ecology movement per se. And we are on the brink of people who worried about, you know, concentration and meatpacking. All of a sudden that became pretty salient this year, right? As they, as slaughterhouses also became charnel houses, where meatpackers were dying and sickening due to massive concentration in the sector that allows them to treat their workers really badly. Chicken farmers have some of the highest suicide rate in the country. It's because there's only three major chicken packers left. And there's a process that they use called chickenization for their labor force, where the farmers are technically independent workers, but they have to buy the coop that that Purdue tells them to buy. They have to buy the feed. They have to use the medicine. They have to put the chickens on the lighting schedule that Purdue specifies. And then Purdue tells them how much they're going to pay at the very end. And they get to calculate it so it's just enough to keep them growing chickens, but not enough to let them go ahead. And if that sounds familiar, it's because it's the same thing that Uber drivers have to deal right. with. So every sector is facing this kind of both monopoly and monopsony, where you have a buyer who's concentrated all the power among their suppliers, and you also have a seller who's concentrated all the power among the consumers. And it's like an hourglass, and there are these people who are manning the pinch between the two bulbs. And, you know, we like to think that those of us on this side of the bulb have nothing in common with those of us on that side of the bulb. It's not true. We're like, we're all on the same side. We're on the side of people who want to get rid of the people in the middle running the pinch. And this is how we got trust busting, you know, 100 years ago. This is how we got the New Deal, is that people woke up one day and they said, Standard Oil is the same problem as the rail trust, is the same problem as the electricity trust, is the same problem as AT&T, is the same problem as A&P. And they got together and they made common cause. And, you know, we're coming to that moment again, or at least that's how I think we can find our way out of it.
Corey, I think if you successfully unite all of these causes into a single cause, we should retain chickenization as the word that describes what happens to the victims.
I totally agree. I learned that word from a Zephyr Teachout book that just came out called Break 'Em Up, but she got it from someone else, and I forget who it is, someone who wrote a big expose on the meatpacking industry. But, you know, like, it's the same thing with farmers. It's the same thing with hospitals, right? Like, the reason that hospitals are as brittle as they are, the reason our medical system is as brittle as it is because private equity funds have been buying and merging hospitals and making them more and more debt loaded, laying off primary staff and hiring them back as contractors, doing all the stuff they did that made Toys R Us into a failing business, except it's our entire healthcare system, such as it is in this country. So, yeah, you know,
it's also a lot where J.C. Penney went and
Sears.
Sears, yeah.
Yeah,
it's an, you know, what's happening. What's actually the good thing about COVID-19 is all the fractures in society are being brought to the surface because they are brittle, and and all it took was you know, a little crack, and the whole thing is starting to shatter, and it doesn't look good. It's gonna. I fear though that it's gonna be a very disruptive period of several decades as we work this all out. And I'm not at all.
Oh heck yeah.
I'm not at all convinced that your side's going to win. I feel like the pinch has a lot of power. And you know, it's interesting how you bring up the word ecology, because the other thing that they do is they change the language. So it used to be everybody was against pollution. Nobody's for pollution. Mm-hmm. But you change it to climate change. Well, now we can have a debate. And there are all sorts of techniques that the people in power use to keep us from revolting against the chickenization of the world. Very
well,
interesting.
That's why I call
stuff.
It the climate emergency instead of climate change.
Yeah, that's a better
I
way.
Think it's a good term for all of us to adopt.
Yeah. Yeah, nobody's against pollution. Nobody's for pollution. Everybody's against pollution. But climate change, well, who knows what that is? Maybe it's just a natural force. Another favorite all year long, Odocta. Of course, this was a very difficult year for the United States in race relations. Odocta had something, I think, very powerful to say about that, and I thought we really should include it in our best of watch.
So first thing, great show. I was super quiet today because there were people that were vastly smarter than me, and I didn't feel like dueling and getting stabbed to death, so that's why I was quiet. I can learn something, too. I was taking notes. I got spellings to check up on after the show, so I got some work to do to get myself together for this episode. But I get a lot of emails from people after I'm on this show, and
most of them are great. Some people yell at me and they have a problem with me. And I fully understand how they can seem that like I'm so angry, or some people think I'm too happy. So I just want to tell you one experience of mine so that you understand like the climate that we're in the world when you see people get frustrated and they lash out. Okay. I'm doing pretty well for myself at a certain point in time. I say I'm going to buy a big house. I buy a big house in a nice neighborhood, 3,000 square feet, 3-car garage. It's only me and my daughter, but I feel like I deserve it, so I get it. In the 3 years that I lived there, I got pulled over 87 times in that neighborhood or generally around that area. I only got 6 tickets. So you do the math on how many times I was pulled over for no reason, just because I had a nice car and I look like I look and I'm in a nice area. Back when Sandy hit, a big storm, people kind of know about it. The power went out of my house. I went to go stay at a friend's house in Philadelphia. I come back home, my house is robbed. $50,000 worth of equipment, my computers, my cameras, all the stuff that I do and use to make a living for myself were all gone. They left the TVs on the wall because I guess they couldn't get them out, but everything else of electronic value was gone. I didn't call the police out to my home. I went to the police station to file a report. The detective, as he's taking down the report, he said, well, why didn't you call us out to the house? And I said, I've seen videos of people calling police when their home's been invaded and they've been shot. And he looked at me and said, fair point.
Took down the police report.
I filed my insurance company. Now, sadly for me, they did take my safe, which had a lot of my receipts, the paperwork receipts in there. And I had copies of them scanned in the cloud. But the insurance company kind of screwed me out of $60,000 of equipment because they said that I could falsify these documents that were scanned because I don't have the paper documentation. So I get really frustrated with my life. I think to myself, I've been pulled over so many times in this nice, beautiful home. It's too big for me anyway. I'm going to sell it, take a loss, and move. As I'm packing up to move with my daughter, you have the door open. Have you ever moved out of a place? I left the door open because I'm coming in and out. I come downstairs. There's 12 cops outside my house.
Jesus.
11 in the front. No, 10 in the front, 2 in the back. Guns drawn. Sir, do you have ID? What are you doing here? Blah, 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 blah. I said, whoa, what's going on? They're like, oh, we've had a lot of robberies on the street. I'm like, yeah, I know. I'm one of the people. Well, I need your license to register. What do you need my license? There's moving boxes here. I'm packing up with my child. Why do I have to get you my ID? Now, mind you, all these people have guns in their hands and they're all very anxious. And I'm just like, dude, my detective's name is Detective. His actual name is Michael Jackson, funny enough. His name is Michael Jackson. How would I know the detective? Like, I've had a gun pulled on me by cops 4 times in my lifetime. The first time I was 11 years old and it took another cop to come and grab that cop and say, hey, this is a kid. Put your gun down. So I do know that there's crazy people that shouldn't have guns and there's good people that have common sense working in that business. But I take it back to where I was living at in that time frame. Lost everything. Still got harassed. But you would know that I come on this show and I make jokes and I have fun and I just do what I got to do. And I'm ranting and raving and Josh jocking because that's the way I have to live my life. And those are the things I have to deal with on a regular basis. So when you see things out in the world, you wonder why people get so upset. It's because I'm not the only person that gets pulled over all the time for no reason. I'm not the only person that gets harassed for no reason. I'm not the only person that's had a gun pulled on them for literally no reason. But I have to go on about my day and be thankful and say, sorry, yes, sir, no, sir. And toe the line. And I say that to say, tomorrow I'm putting up a video from 2 years ago from me and Ant that I've recorded because I got so depressed and all my stuff got stolen, I never posted it. But I'm trying to be in my Chadwick Boseman and tell you again to do better. Even though I built myself back up, I got all my cameras back, I got all my lenses back, I worked hard, I bought new stuff, I got a new insurance company, and I've gotten myself back on my feet. But you can do the same thing, too. So if you're having a bad day, you're down. I know somebody tweeted me earlier and said, I seem like I'm sad. I'm really sad about this Boswick thing because I really think to myself, I'm fat, I'm overweight, I'm living in a pandemic. I could die any day, and I should be doing more. So again, I encourage you to do more. And if you're still listening, I know you care enough to at least try for yourself. I'm your boy, J.J. Stone, a.k.a. O'Doctor, another Twits in the Can. Got you, Uncle Leo.
Bless you, O'Doctor. God, we love you. Thank you. God. Yeah, bravo. That's why we like these closers. He's the best. Thank you, Owen. We're almost done. Our last segment of the show, the inventors of live blogging. Remember those days, Peter, when you had to sit and live blog an announcement? You don't do that anymore, I bet.
I don't, but we were the first site to do that.
Were you? You mean Engadget?
Yeah.
Nice.
We had somebody, the way you used to do it is the connections were so slow that one person would be there in the room, and then they would be sending the messages over AIM.
Oh my God, on AIM.
Who would then put it into the CMS.
Oh my God.
See, this is what we need on the Internet History Podcast.
See, that's how long ago it was. They were using AOL's Instant Messenger, the late great.
It was a real process.
Right.
And this was whole software. They have software platforms for that now, right?
Oh yeah, they totally. Yeah, well, they did. You know what? They may be gone now. For a while, there was this boom in live blogging, and they had a bunch of platforms. I bet they're all gone by now.
I think they are.
A lot of the sites have their own.
Yeah, but they do their own thing.
I think at one point there was a plugin for AIM that where you could essentially use it to live blog, and it would send it to certain CMSs. So you could actually do it directly. You wouldn't need the other guy typing it in.
I think some of this went away when companies like Apple, thank God, finally started live streaming instead of, you know, they'd put it up on YouTube so the public could watch.
Yeah.
And so we wouldn't have to go to Engadget to see what's going on. Yeah, there's still some live blog, 24liveblog.com, real-time infrastructure for today's newsroom. So there are still some businesses doing that. It's fun when you can get all of these segments together. It's really fun to see the breadth, the depth, the fascinating conversations, the really great panelists we have on Twit. Twit is the one show we do all week long that has a rotating cast. And the reason I do it that way is because there are too many people I want to talk to every week. There are too many shows I want to do. So with Twit, I'm able to each week try a different bunch of people, bring them together. We get great conversations. Sometimes bring in experts on the topics that everybody was talking about that week. Sometimes we just bring in somebody because it's time to have some fun. But every week on Twit is, I think, well worth listening to. I hope so. I feel that way. I hope you do too. Thank you for being with us all year. I look forward to a very interesting and let's hope a healthy 2021. Have a wonderful holiday. It's been great so far, I hope. We'll see you next year with more great episodes than This Week in Tech. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for joining me. Another Twit is in the can. Amazing. Bye-bye.